CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO Radio. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, Financial Executives International, the preeminent association for CFOs and other financial executives. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter. And National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And thank you very much for listening in today. We are today speaking with Joyce Bone. She is what I would describe as a serial entrepreneur, fabulous woman. She's an executive that has taken a company public. She also has a book called Millionaire Mums, The Art of Raising a Business and a Family at the Same Time. Welcome to the show, Joyce.
Thanks, Lorraine. I like how you said that, mums.
Sorry, mums with a U. Well, tell us a little bit about your background, Joyce. I'm going to take you way, 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 way back.
That sounds really bad, Lorraine.
Not so back for you, maybe. But what was your first job? Was it a paper round? Were you selling ice cream or lemonade on the local stand? What was your first job?
Well, my first entrepreneurial pursuit, I was age 5, and I found a bunch of frogs in the lot down the street from where I live. So I put them in a shoebox, and I went door to door and sold the little ones for a dime and the big ones for a quarter. And my unique selling proposition, my USP, was that they are good for your garden. And I was really cute because I had pigtails and I was a 5-year-old girl. So I did quite well in my first business.
And were they good for the garden?
They eat little bugs and, I think they're good for the garden.
There you go. Marketing sells, right?
That's right.
So beyond that, what was the next venture?
Well, I babysat and I would track during the summer. I babysat all the time. So I had a poster board in my bedroom and every day I'd note how much money I made. And during the summer I made over like $1,200 one summer at $2 an hour. So I was putting in a lot of work, a lot of hours, but I loved it, so it was fun. And then my first real job lasted one day. I was hired at 13 to wash hair in a hair salon, and I was really excited because I was going to get paid $30 from 8 a.m to 6 p.m at night. And I was like, $30? The only problem was when they came to pick me up, they honked the horn. It was a lady I babysat for, owned the salon. I fell down the stairs and broke my arm. So I washed hair all day with a broken arm. And so that was the beginning and end of my hair washing career. The old ladies were like, "You can scrub harder, honey. My head's hard as nails." But my first, I guess, W-2 job was as a salad bar girl at Shoney's when I was 15.
Wow. So you tracked a couple of jobs before you were 15,
16. Oh, I usually had about 3 or 4 at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. I worked through high school I played basketball after school and then I'd go to work.
Tell us a little bit about the basketball, because one of the things that we found on the radio show is that a lot of the most successful women in business actually played sports, and typically team sports.
Yes, I loved sports. I was the only girl on the soccer league in fourth or fifth grade. They didn't have girls soccer like they do now. So I did that, and I actually got punched in the stomach by this kid, and I started brawling with him in the middle of the field. And then fast forward to high school and homecoming, and I'm on this homecoming date, and the guy goes, "I'm really sorry I punched you in the stomach when you were in fourth grade." I goes, "That was you? You're lucky I don't wail on you now." But, so I was on diving team for 5 years. I played softball all the way through, actually co-ed into my adulthood. That was a lot of fun. Basketball, track. I just love sports. And it does teach you a great deal about teamwork, getting along with all different types of people, because you don't always love all your teammates, but you learn how to become family in spite of it and create your culture. So I would say that there's a tremendous amount to be learned by playing sports. And if I had any girls, I would certainly encourage them to play.
Now, talking of millionaire moms, you are a mom yourself, and you have boys.
That's correct. Three boys.
Okay. Tell us, do a little bit of shout for the boys. How old are they?
They won't listen. They're 16, 8. Wait, no, 16, 12, and 8. Wonderful. So my 12-year-old is actually at UPS this morning with my sister at Bring Your Kid to Work Day. So since she didn't have any, she borrowed mine. And so he'll get a good education today about UPS.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, let's reconnect in terms of a little bit more of your entrepreneurial path. I have heard you speak about bootstrapping, and I know that we're going to be talking about that. That's an element where I truly believe as a business you should make the best use of monies that you have and cash flow. But I want to step a little bit further back than that, because you have quite a history of doing the bootstrapping yourself. The first business that entrepreneurially I'm aware of that you had in a large scale was that in waste management, but you'd worked in waste management before. So tell us a little bit of an evolution of your waste management and the company that you had and how it came about.
Sure. Well, I've been bootstrapping my whole life because my father encouraged it. He didn't pay our way. There were six of us, and you know, we were expected to figure things out ourselves. So that was a good beginning for me. Although at the time, I would have much preferred, you know, cash or check from Dad. But I had to figure out how to pay for my college, and that's what actually led me into the waste world. That wasn't what I was thinking about, but I was actually modeling at another event, and at time for dinner you sat down at any table, and I sat down at the table I ultimately ended up working for. And I think a lot of business in general, I had been hired to model because the year before I'd been working banquets, but and I was personable. So the person who put on the event said, hey, next year would you like to come and work on this side? I said, sure. You know, I asked how much it paid, and it's was fun. And so I said, okay. So from there, I sat down at the table and I was personable with the people there. And they ended up offering me, you know, basically a gopher position. And I worked my way up to partner with the owner ultimately. But that was through hard work and proving my worth.
And this was within waste management.
Yes, this was within waste management. So for my last 2 years, and which is also where I got the basis for the idea of my company that I ended up taking public, was I worked full-time during the day, and I went to school full-time at night for 2 years. No vacation days, every day, Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 11:30 at night. So I worked really hard, but I was young and had lots of energy. So I watched my boss make a tremendous amount of money building his business and then selling it off to national consolidators in the waste world. So, you know, everybody's familiar with waste management and BFI, and all these different companies were in acquisition mode. So they would go around and buy these small mom and pops. Well, he built and sold three times during the time that I worked for him over the 8 years. So I retired, quote unquote, when I decided to become a stay-at-home mom. Little did I know that would be the hardest job ever. But I was at home and I realized that we needed more income. We
and
had
this
gone
was,
from.
You were in your 20s
I
at
was
this point?
I had my first child when I was 27.
Okay.
So at the time, I was 27, and I started thinking, well, this is not fun. Not having money is not fun. This I know. So I decided to start my own business. And I sat down every day for 10 days, and I wrote three ideas a day, no matter how silly they were. And you know, like one of my great ideas was to create a pneumatic tube from my front door to my mailbox, because I lived on a hill, so everybody could have pneumatic tubes instead of walking to get their mail. So I thought, well, I don't really know a whole lot about that. At the end of the 10 days, all these ideas, I knew I wanted to make a lot of money. I knew they wouldn't get me there. So I started thinking, well, what do I know? And I just happened to have lunch with my old boss.
Had he retired at this point?
He had retired, yes. Okay. He had was living in a beautiful 13,000 square foot home, 150 acres out in Ball Ground. So we were friends, and so we went to lunch, and he asked me what I was up to, and I shared with him. And as I was sharing with him, I looked at him, and I went, that's the answer. That's what I need to do. I need to do what he did. He made a lot of money. So I said, hey, Raymond, I have an idea. It just hit me. Why don't we do what you did, but this time we go buy the companies instead of building the company and selling it. We go buy other companies. And so he's like, he'd been retired for several years, and he was, I don't know, in his late 60s, early 70s, bored. So he's like, what are you thinking? And I said, well, how about liquid waste? You know, there's no national companies doing that, really. So he's like, oh, that sounds interesting. Proverbial cocktail napkin kind of thing. And we walked out of O'Charlie's restaurant and shook hands on it. And for this next 6 months, I put together a business plan and kept feeding him information of what I found out. And, you know, this is right before the internet exploded. And I would go to Kennesaw State University and sit in their library and do research and feed him. So I did a lot of work. No guarantee of being paid, which, you know, people need to get over, you know, their ideas of, you know, instant everything. So ultimately, he saw that it was a viable idea, and we ended up going to the national conference for non-hazardous liquid waste. I'm like, wow. So it was he, myself, and his wife, and we walked the floor, and we saw the fragmented marketplace. You could literally see it. You know, it'd be families in satin jackets that said, you know, Bob's Honey Truck, or, you know. And at first, it was difficult getting these business owners to take me seriously because I was 28 years old at this point.
And did you have investment at that point in time? Did you have funding?
Well, Raymond was my first.
Okay. Oh, so the 6 months you were sitting with Raymond at O'Charlie's, you were buttering him up to put the money forward.
Right.
Ah, exactly. Interesting. And did he do that willingly?
He was my partner.
Okay.
We partnered.
Okay.
So, yes, he put $1 million in, and I went and got a line of credit at Nations Bank for $13 million, not based on my tremendous purchasing power, but because of his history. And I put in $10,000, which was all my savings.
Wow.
So he insisted that I have, you know, he said, how much money do you have in your savings? And I said, 10,000. He's like, okay, put it all in. And I'm like, all of it? He's like, yeah. So I said, all right, fine.
So he knew you were committed.
Right. He wanted skin in the game. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the best entrepreneur I ever met. And he knew. And you have to have skin in the game. And I counsel a lot of people, a lot of beginning entrepreneurs, and they're always trying to get out of having any risk, and it's right. Like that's just not going to happen.
An investor typically isn't going to look at you unless you've got real skin in the game.
Exactly. Like, why should they take a risk if you're not willing to?
And the challenge that I see is that very often they think skin in the game is, this is the amount of time I've committed to
right. It.
I've spent 2 years making this opportunity, and the investor says, no, how much cash have you put in the business?
Yeah. Exactly.
Basically the investor doesn't want to just spend money to give you a payroll.
No, absolutely. That's not how it
works. So you were invested. You had 10,000 in. He put in $1 million and
yes.
went and got a line of credit at
for 13 million.
So
we
now
bought
you have
first business.
14 million and 10,000 in a bank account.
That's right. And that 10,000 put us over the top. I'm telling you. So we started buying businesses, and
how much did your first business cost? Do you remember?
$750,000.
Wow.
And that was the start of, you know, we evolved our business plan, because originally we were just going to really do grease traps at restaurants, because, you know, it's garbage is reoccurring revenue. It's like boom, boom, boom. So we thought, well, what's non-hazardous liquid waste that is reoccurring? Restaurants have grease traps. I didn't even know what a grease trap was, really, going into it. And they have yellow grease. And the problem was, it's not as regular as garbage. It's like once a quarter, and then it has to be, you know, the state says you're supposed to have it pumped once a quarter. Not everybody follows that rule. Actually, most people don't. So I had to expand the business model out to include septic companies, plumbers, jetting. We had to expand it out because we realized very early on at $750,000 a pop, we're not going to grow to public size very quickly. Mm. So that's when we started expanding that out. So it was all about evolving as we went. And so that's what we did.
So how many years were you buying these companies?
Well, I was in and out in 18 months.
Wow.
I started the company, helped hire. We had senior vice presidents for all the key areas, operations, marketing, you know, all that.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you've got a 12-month, 18-month baby at home?
Yes.
Wow.
He was actually 22 months when I was at the first conference where nobody knew who we were. And the next year we had the biggest booth. Everybody in that industry knew who we were. And, you know, I'd go into the first couple of businesses. Here's this 28-year-old female. And I'd be like, I'm here to buy your business. And they'd be like, what do you know about the
doo-doo
business? But they used a different word.
And
I said, well, I know enough to be sitting here with a big fat checkbook. Do you want to talk to me or not? And, you know, after the first one or two, people started talking, and, you know, then it became much easier to buy businesses.
So in terms of them taking you seriously, do you have any funny stories? I seem to remember one that you told me a while back.
Yes. Well, all you guys out there, dirty dogs. No, I walked in the first business I bought. I was so excited. I was like, ta-cha! You know, I walk
here
in the
I
door
am.
Expecting to hear angels singing and sunlight because I purchased the first business with Raymond. And this guy walks up to me. He said, are you new here? I'd been there less than 30 seconds. I said, well, yeah, I guess you could say I am. He goes, great. We've been needing extra help. Here's, could you make me 50 copies of this? And I thought, oh, he thinks I'm the new secretary. I'm like, well, here's a culture building moment. I have a decision to make. I could either be, you know, really nasty, or I could be very helpful. So I chose to be helpful. And I said, sure, I'll be happy to make those copies for you. You know, where's the copier? And he pointed me in the way. And I made him his copies, and he went on his way. And then 30 minutes later, the old owner brought the whole company together. And I think there was like 30 to 50 employees in that company. And he lined them, you know, all up, and he said, I've sold the company. I want to introduce the new owner. And I walked out, and all I could see in this sea of faces was these two giant eyeballs staring at me like, oh, no.
And this is that guy.
Yes.
That was him. How did your relationship go with him?
It went fine until I had to fire him. So he was the first person I ever fired. Because he got into it with one of the customers. And I remember sitting in my office crying because I had to fire him. And it was right before Christmas. And all I could think about, see, this is the difference between men and women, I think. Yeah. I'm thinking about his wife and his kids and it's Christmas. And then this guy that worked in a different company that was in the same building saw me. He said, what's wrong? And I told him, I said, oh, I got to fire, you know, so-and-so. He's like, Joyce, you're not firing him. He fired himself. And I went, I like that. You're right. He did fire himself. I gave him every opportunity to clean up his act, and he couldn't do it. It's not my fault. He's blown the best job that he's ever going to have, most likely. And I fired him, but I did give him an extra $200 for Christmas gifts for his kids. And so I said, you know, good luck with the wife. You're going to need it.
So you moved on, you bought multiple other businesses, and you took the company public.
That's correct. We had, when I left, we had 350 employees, and we had gotten to 50 million. We did a reverse merger on NASDAQ. So
explain to the listeners what that is.
In essence, it's like you're buying a company that is dead and is on life support, but it's kept its filings up to date, because when you go public, you have to keep your filings current. And it was a shell. It's called a shell. And you buy the company, and then you merge your company into it, and then you're public. So it's a much less expensive way to go public. Sometimes you have difficulty raising your second round of funding, but it's great for somebody like us that didn't really have, you know, didn't want to go into that expense and tedious nature of doing it the other way.
And Raymond's still with you at this point?
Yes. Yes. He was with us. And then, you know, we had a conversation about what the next phase would be. And, you know, I went from sitting at my kitchen table thinking about pneumatic tubes to running a company with 350 employees and 50 million in revenue. So I knew I had kind of gone as far as my knowledge base. So we decided, or, you know, it was really his decision, because I always felt like it was his bat and his ball. And I remember my other working partner, we would go out and do the acquisitions, the mergers and all, and acquisitions. He would complain when he'd do the crunching of numbers about how much we would make versus how much Raymond would make. And, you know, there was a giant gap. I said, you know what? I'm just glad Raymond has some big old crumbs because I would never have this opportunity with anybody else. So I think you should be grateful. And it was a significant number. We would not be starving.
Raymond did pretty well, but you did pretty well too.
Right.
So how much did you go public for? What was the share price?
We started out at $24. So it was a really good start because, you know, Raymond had street cred, and we went to all our waste management friends, you know, the Hisingas of the world, and we did very well.
Well, that's
and this was now, let me preface this by saying this is not 2011. This was 1997 when, you know, people, you could just dump money in your car. It seemed like everybody was doing IPOs. And that's another point I wanted to bring across is work with the trends. When I started this, I knew IPOs were hot, and you know, I was going with the trends instead of against. It's so much easier to make money when you're going with what's happening in the world.
And there's not a lot of IPOs at all out there right now.
No.
But there's not a lot of acquisitions.
No. It would not be the approach I would take today.
So let's talk a little bit about, and let me, for purposes of the audience, let them know, you then went on to interviewing a couple of dozen millionaire mums that had, like yourself, you were a mother, you were working, you were making money, you were managing the family, and you have gone through, what, about a 5, 6, 7 years period where you've been helping young mothers be able to get their business off the ground. And you have a book that has supported that and an internet site and so forth called Millionaire Mums.
That's correct.
Talk a little bit about that stage of your life.
Well, I felt fairly isolated, as especially in 1997, before the internet kicked in big time. I was a female in a totally male, I've always been in male dominated worlds, from garbage to liquid garbage to having three boys. And so I thought it'd be really great to connect with other women, because I remember when we had to raise the second round of funds, I had to stand up and present to about 50 accredited investors about our company. And it was kind of on me to make sure that we raise those funds. And I was freaking out. I was in the, because I didn't, had never spoken in public. And I was literally hyperventilating. I was like, oh, I'm like, all right, Joyce, pull it together, put on your big girl panties and get out there and knock it out of the park. And I, you know, it was a big blur, but I did it. We raised the money. And, but at that point I thought, you know, every single person, especially women, need to be able to stand and deliver their message without fainting. So I thought that was going to be really lame if that happened.
So that was your own lesson, and you were taking it
to other
women.
That was my own lesson. I thought, well, what can I share with other women, you know, about my experiences? And of course, they'll have plenty to share themselves. So I decided to put together this book, and I just started interviewing different millionaire moms. And everybody came from different walks of life. Everything that you can imagine, every business, from a quarry to a multi-level marketing millionaire mom to you name it, McDonald's franchisees. And I tried to come up, well, what's the common thread when I was finished interviewing them? I'm like, what is it? And bottom line was, all of these women pulled it off for their kids. You know, they had children. They needed to make the money. A lot of them were single moms, you know, didn't have the support of a husband, and they had to make it happen. So that, I thought, was a real testament to women and, you know, their love of their children. So it came about after my brother passed away, because it was a good time. It's a reflective mode when you lose somebody close to you. And I thought, you know, is it all about making money? Well, the answer is yes, but no kidding. I went into a mode of wanting to give back, which, you know, is part of who I am anyhow. But so I put this book together to help women.
And at this point, you had three children by yourself.
Oh, no, I have a husband.
And you have a husband.
Yeah.
Okay,
I'm
so you had
fortunate
a husband at home helping.
That I have a supportive husband. We've been together 23 years. He got me out of my crib and stole me.
Wonderful.
But so, you know, that is a major important decision, is who you marry, because, you know, if you have to split up and give half your assets away, that's not so nice.
Sure. You know? So Millionaire Mums, is that still in existence today?
It is. It's kind of running itself. I give talks. I speak to different corporations on different topics. Part of, you know, a lot of times I speak with women's groups, and talk about the book primarily when I'm in front of women, and it's just perking along.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So
and how did you raise the funds for that, or did you self fund?
I just self-funded it.
Okay.
Yeah. I would, and today is wonderful because it's so easy to start a business. So easy, so inexpensive.
Do you have any suggestions for the listeners here that might have a creative idea and haven't thought about how to start a business? What would your first suggestion be?
My first suggestion is make sure you're playing to the trends. You know, Google top industries for 2011. You know, don't be like, I'm going to start a, you know, tomato hybrid plant system. Yeah, in today's economy, it's like,
do you market research?
You need to have every benefit pushing your way, every little, you know, benefit that you can have to help you succeed. And you have to be 100% committed. Mm-hmm. I mean, usually successful entrepreneurs, if you ask them, would you do it again? They'll laugh because they'll be like, if I had known what I was going to be going through to create this company, I probably wouldn't have started, but am I glad I did it? Absolutely. So
what you today are affiliated with one or two investment groups. And as an investor, what are the top two or three things that you look for? Is it the passion of the individual? Is it how committed they are? Is it the business plan itself? Is it the people that they have surrounding them? What is it that you look for as an investor?
Well, as an investor, I look at the people involved, their character, their commitment, what they've done to date. I look at the numbers, you know, is it going to be profitable? But over and above that, I've learned over time from having made some bad investments that I only invest in areas that I know about. I get people coming to me all the time about movies. I'm like, I've never made a movie. I don't know anything about movies. I'm not going to do that. And I just say, you know, I just tell people, sorry, I'm out of gambling money.
Because
that's what it is. If I'm going to gamble, I'm gambling on Joyce because I know Joyce pretty darn well. And she's going to do everything.
So
my husband gets so mad if I say my name in third person. So excuse me for that.
So anybody that has waste management opportunities, come on.
Right.
To
you. Exactly.
That's what you know.
Right. Or internet marketing. That kind of thing. And I'm also studying stockpiling, the Warren Buffett process of buying stocks. So right now, I just think people really need help building their investment portfolios. There's no yield in the market. So that is the direction I'm heading. I understand real estate because after I finished with EarthCare, the company we took public, I, like I said, retired for about 2 years, had another baby, and started getting bored. So I decided to get into real estate. So I bought a 54-hole miniature golf course. And the reason why I bought it was, one, it was family friendly. I could bring my kids with me. And the primary reason I bought it was there were cell towers on the back of the property that was generating $25,000 in passive revenue. I'm all about passive revenue. That's my bottom line. I like to do the work once and get paid over and over. So I bought the golf course to get control of the cell tower, and then I sold it. It took me 2 or 3 years to finally sell it to a townhome developer because it kind of was a little dog-eared and had its day, but I kept the cell towers. So I did that. I rehabbed houses, flipped them so I could go on the Disney cruise. You know, I was just kind of goofing around, keeping busy, but I learned an awful lot about real estate, and I decided, you know, I could make sense to me. Real estate, you know, I got out of it because I, that's another thing. You have to be aware of what's going on around you. I had some rental properties and I unloaded them because I was like, you know, anybody who can fog a mirror is getting a loan. This is not right. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not an economic person, okay? Mm-hmm. But I can smell when something's off. Mm-hmm. So I said, it's time for Joyce to bail. So I sold all my real estate holdings except for one house that I wanted to keep. So I got out of the market, but now I'm getting back into the market because now, you know, everything's fallen. You know, history's on the side of the investors that make bold moves during difficult times. And that's really what I want to start teaching people now is how to make those bold moves, but make them in a very smart way. It's common sense investing is what we call it, because it is. It doesn't have to be crazy difficult. Every time I put trust in, you know, the experts, you have to look at people's motivations. What are they there for? They're there to get their fees. They're there for you to pay for their country club membership. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not about that. We're about helping, you know, everybody from the average investor to the accredited investor get really good, safe yield on their investments. So we're going, my partner in this is Richard Sims, and he's got over 9 million in apartments, and he bought them at the peak of the market, but he was smart. He bought them, you know, with, I think the term's MOS, where he bought them at discounted rates up to 50%, even when the market was high. So now that the market's low, we can position ourselves and our investors to make a killing. So that's what we're doing. We're doing niche apartments in the 75 to 200 unit range because it's too small for the big REITs to be interested in, too big for the average investor to feel comfortable. And we're going to put together a fund and get some really good yields for our investors.
That's fabulous. So what is the Joyce of tomorrow? What after the REIT, do you have another creative idea, or can you even air it on the show? Will somebody maybe steal it?
No, actually, I don't worry about that. You know, most people are lazy. They don't want to work that hard. I work hard. Mm-hmm. People don't want to be me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Looks good on the outside, but I work really hard.
Sure.
You know, I got up at 5 o'clock every morning to write that book when I was in MBA school and raising 3 children and running 2 businesses. So if you want to steal my book idea, have at it. Let me know how that works for you.
Do you have another book?
I do. We're going to write one based on what we're doing with the
REITs.
Yeah, with the REITs.
Fabulous.
So that'll be our next book. We'll create a system for other people to put that into play for themselves. And then once, you know, we do really well with that, I would like to put together a retreat center to, you know, for middle income people to come and have some peace and thinking time for themselves. I find that when I'm in nature, I live on the river, so I go and I have my first meeting with the fly fishers in the morning, and I sit out there, drink coffee, and it's very cleansing and helps you think. Mm-hmm. So I would like to have that ultimately as my end game.
So a retreat meaning some kind of a spa retreat, or what are you referring to?
Yes.
Something
make you beautiful from the inside out.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice. Well, I hope that I'm able to stick around with you, because I enjoy that sort of stuff too. I think we all work very hard, and we've got to make sure that we balance the life of a little bit of pleasure, a little bit of fun, a mm-hmm. little bit of work, and that kind of makes the circle.
That's right. Exactly.
So one thing that I do want to step back on before we finish up on the show, I would like to understand a little bit more about some of your philosophies on bootstrapping. We've heard that Raymond, one of your partners and investors, asked you to put in your worldly wealth, that $10,000. What suggestions do you have for others in terms of what I refer to as bootstrapping, or what I understand is making the best out of the cash flow that you can? I guide clients and friends and entrepreneurs that come to me always to get the cash up front. If you can negotiate, even if you're losing a percentage point or two, but that you can get them to pay cash in advance, that's better than the terms that you're going to get through a bank or any kind of an investor. You're not giving up your own stock. Are those the sorts of philosophies that you have around bootstrapping, or do you have something a little bit more enhanced than that?
Well, you probably are smarter than me at knowing how to do factoring and how to get the money up front kind of thing. I've always come from, you know, just trying to figure out how to play to my strengths, first of all, and to minimize my weaknesses by having other people support me. So how do you get those people to support you? How do you get your business going? For myself, I just look at the situation. I wanted to do this sales training. It was $15,000. I was like, I don't want to pay for that sales training. So I went and negotiated a deal where they're one of my sponsors. So, you know, they get the benefit of me thanking them and working with them. And I occasionally speak for them. And I got the sales training. So that was a good barter. So I do a lot of bartering.
Do you encourage small businesses to do that?
I do.
And there are some formal bartering companies out there where you as a small business unit or business company can go to them and say, hey, I'm an accountant or I'm a lawyer or I'm in waste management or I'm in marketing. I have these skills. I need office supplies or I need benefits coverage. And there'll be other players in the market and all of you can barter.
Right. I've never formally joined a bartering club, but everybody I know who ever has been very pleased. So I would encourage you to check that out. You were saying the right thing. The best way to bootstrap your business is to have your customers pay you in advance. So for what I do, I could sell a coaching package in advance and then put together, you know, let's say I'm doing it on sales from all that training I got. Then I could pre-sell the program, get the cash in, and use it to do whatever.
Fund other businesses.
Right, sure, right. So. Sure. Yeah, the sooner you get the cash in, the better. And the more you are cognitive of every dollar. Now, I was guilty of that up front because I had extra money. So I blew extra money. And really, it's almost to your benefit. I know a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I don't have a friend with $1 million. Well, why not? What's wrong with you? You know, you are who you hang around with.
Yes.
The five people that you spend the most time with, it's been shown in studies that your income levels are all within, you know, close range of each other. So if you're hanging around turkeys, you know, get with the eagles. Put yourself in the position to be around people that have money. I used to think country club memberships were silly. And then now I realize, oh, well, that's where all the deals are going on over there. They're not. And they're very lovely facilities.
So have you joined a country club?
I have not yet, but I do send my son to a very very good school where all those people that are at the country club are there. So I get to talk to them there. So what else can they do to bootstrap? You can outsource. I know a couple of people that had baking type businesses that would rent time from existing bakeries during the time. You know, it might be 2 a.m., but are you committed or not? So, you know, they would rent time in this bakery, make their products, and then go sell them in the morning initially until they
could get
their own
bakery. So they're reducing their overheads. They're really just renting space.
Exactly. And the more that you can do that up front, the better off you are.
You get a name for yourself. You get your business name out there. You've got credibility. And then presumably you've got cash flow to be able to go make your own investment in property.
That's right. That's right. So up front, you know, keep your expenses minimized as much as possible. Do some bartering. Do some outsourcing, some rent, whatever it takes to get the job done. I mean, everybody's situation's different. So I can't wave a magic wand and tell them, you know, this is exactly how you do it. But you track and measure. Metrics are everything in a business. And you know, this is CFO Radio. So I'm sure, you know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but being a business communications major, you know, that's not my nature. So I have to tell myself that. Measure everything.
Well, one of the differences that we find is that even finance people, when they go to start their own business, they're often busy managing somebody else's money. And when it comes down to managing their own money, all of a sudden they get the first shock. And the first shock is every dollar you spend is your dollar. And that's a very different entrepreneurial spirit than every dollar you spend is an investor's or a shareholder's.
Yes, it is a much different experience. Mm-hmm. I look at it now that I've tried to really reel myself in and be very smart mm-hmm. with my money is every dollar is a little dollar, you know, money tree seed. Mm-hmm. So even if it's just something silly, it's like, well, there goes a dollar that if you compounded it over 60 years could have been, you know, 100 or 1,000, whatever the number is.
Sure. Well, this has been fabulous, Joyce. I know that from a personal perspective, I could talk with you for hours. I'd like to formally thank you, Joyce Bone, for being on our radio show. It's been fabulous having you. There is one final question, though, we ask all of our guests, and that is typically to the CFO, what is your CFO tip of the month? From your perspective as an entrepreneur and as an investor, what is your finance tip of the month? Is there one particular tip that you might give to an investor or to an entrepreneur that you think is one very important tip that you hold close to you?
Well, I don't have, I would say for myself, I do what's important first. I follow the Pareto principle of the 80-20 rule, where you get 80% of your results from 20% of your work. So every night I write down what it is the next day that's going to project my business the furthest. So I would suggest becoming keenly aware of time management and where you're spending your money.
Fabulous. That's a great tip. Well, thank you, Joyce. It's been a pleasure having you on the radio show.
Oh, it's been fun. Thank you, Lorraine. I appreciate it.
And we'd like to thank our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. And thanks to our other two sponsors, Financial Executive International, the preeminent association for CFOs and finance executives. Their website is financialexecutives.org. And last but not least, National Association for Corporate Directors, advancing exemplary board leadership for directors by directors. Their website is nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off until next time.